Welcome to the Spec Fix Speakeasy, where we talk about the best books you've never heard of and the office behind them. Grab a drink and descend with us into the horror, fantasy, and sci-fi underground. Hi, I'm Walt, owner of Strangle Root Books and Games. Today I'm joined by R.M. Greta as we interview M.A. Knight, author of Fever Chain.
The first episode of this whole, the flow is going to be rough, so just bear with me. Of a series of questions, and then we have a game to play.
Okay.
So, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, in case there's folks listening that don't know who you are.
I am M.A. Knight, not Ma. I wrote Fever Chain, and with the help of a lot of people, and specifically Dylan Bosworth, it is now published and available in paperback and ebook.
Yay.
And yeah, I was born in 1999.
Oof.
And you know, should we go through each year?
Yes.
No. I don't really remember 9/11. Yeah.
Man, I feel old. All right. Thanks for that. I appreciate it.
Sorry.
So sorry.
You guys have such good podcast voices. Like, I'm really jealous right now.
I think your voice works also. I don't know.
I was going to say,
I think your voice is great also.
Yes.
Yeah. It's nice and clear.
Okay, well that's good. I feel like I sound like a cartoon, but I have gotten that before. It's okay.
That's rude.
Yeah.
I am R.M. Greta, and I write also, and I was born in 1987, so I do remember 9/11 and Y2K and all that stuff, and I'm a big fan of Fever Chain. And
yes,
everything that it's done for us as a writing collective.
Yay! All right. So, questions. Let's just go ahead and do that. This is going to be really chaotic, I feel like. And yeah, that's all right, because we're just going to roll with it. I will start us off with, if Pinetown's Diner had a menu item named after the book, what would it be called?
Named after the book. Bloody Sunday, and it's an ice cream sundae with cherry sauce all over it. I don't know.
And peanut butter.
Two reference.
Oh, peanut butter. And peanut butter too. Peanut butter drizzle. That'd be good. It's like a PB&J, like a peanut butter banana jelly sandwich.
I'm down.
Yeah. Next question. Gore and horror is usually coded masculine, like splatter or torture porn, but Fever Chain slots in as femgore. What's technically different about writing that kind of violence centered on a woman's body and from a woman's point of view?
I think that is an excellent question. I think I'm going to also probably struggle to articulate a good answer, but I will try. I feel like, you know, there's a suggestion that, like, you know, masculine in the sense of torture porn, or like, oh, I'm so like tough, or I'm so like strong for like doing these things, and I'm gonna kind of cool and calculated sort of like, you know, tear you apart or rip your nails off or whatever. And I think for, in the feminine sense, I think it is more embodied. I think it's less detached. I think it is more relational also. And I think this is just how, a result of like men and women being socialized differently in part. But I do think that, like, you know, like, I imagine sort of a male torturer, like, you know, with depictions I've seen being sort of like cool and calculated. And there's been the same with, like, you know, the femme fatale kind of thing too. But I think for me, femme gore is a lot more ecstatic and, ooh, for lack of a better word, orgasmic. Maybe that's a bad. We can edit that maybe. No, that's
good. Oh no, that's staying in.
It's good. It's good. I think that's apt for sure.
Okay. Also, yeah, because I was reading Maiden Mother Monster. I think that's the name of it, and it was that it vibes with that for sure.
Okay.
I want to say also the difference that I've seen so far is that no matter how gory you're writing it, the difference is that there's always like an underlayer of empathy that you've added.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's gore like how you said detached. Gore. Yeah, but I still feel like there's empathy. You know, like we're not really watching it from a, I don't know. I can feel the empathy. We're sucked into it. We're not just kind of desensitized watching it
happen. Yeah, you're not just there. Like, it's you care. There's a sense of care that it matters, mm-hmm. rather than it's and just especially something that's happening.
When you're writing it about Gwen's body, we feel bad for Gwen. We're not there to get off on it and, you know, hurt another woman. We feel bad for Gwen, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I should revise orgasmic maybe slightly. it's complicated, right? Like, I don't, yeah, like, I do agree with you, and that is a goal 100% in my writing to do that. And yeah, I feel like I have seen that in Femgore. There is more empathy. And to me, that's just like, that wasn't even a goal. To me, that's just like, I feel like that's good writing is with empathy, because that's more real. Like, I guess my perception of reality, maybe it's more empathetic than like some people. It's probably not as empathetic as other people's, but how I perceive reality and what feels real to me does have that level of empathy. And I don't always see that reflected in art, but I usually see it a little bit more reflected in art that is, you know, made by people who were socialized as women growing up, but that's not always the case, of course.
Excellent points. And honestly, I feel like that empathic point of view does tend to skew feminine in kind of all the arts, I would say. I mean, obviously it's not a binary. It's, you know, it's not men are not empathy, empath. Yeah, it's not a binary, but yes. Okay, yeah. I'm gonna shut up now. All right, next question.
Next.
How do you choreograph a scene that has to hit as both erotic and horrific at the same beat? And there are some of those in Fever Chain.
So then we come back to the orgasmic thing.
Something can be, ooh, okay. Yeah, I have, no, should I go there? No, I don't think so, sorry.
You can go where you want. This is R-rated, 18 plus.
If you go there, I'll meet you there.
All right. I'm ready.
Okay.
Haven't we all had? No, I don't think I should say that. I'm gonna say, you know, not every sexual experience is perfect. Sometimes they can be profoundly awkward and uncomfortable, or slightly, you know, and that's all very normal. It's just like, to me at least, it's like anything else. It can have these multiple strains going on. At the same time, your body could be feeling something that maybe doesn't fully match up with how you are thinking, I guess. So there's that too of, you know, they're not always being in alignment. I mean, obviously, ideally there is. Wow, I'm really rambling. I don't know if I should go there. But
you're saying the disconnect between conscious thought and unconscious bodily reactions.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Walt.
Well, the example, I think, is when Bianca howls for Gwen, and she's like, this is not right, but I like it. it's that kind of meeting, you know, in a way.
Yeah, that's a, I would say, yeah, like that's kind of a one where like it's sort of a realization of like, wait, what, that's like, what the hell am I doing? That's weird. And you know, it's not really how she would perceive herself, like, you know, doing this, a person who would do something like that and find it pleasurable, but she sort of like discovers it through doing it. And you know, that's a little supernatural there, but also, you know, not.
Well, and they're also having this very, I thought it was an erotic connection between two of them, you know, in the midst of all this bloodshed.
Yes, totally. I agree.
Totally. Yeah, that definitely is an element there. And it's slightly supernatural, slightly just, you know, good old yearning and maybe codependence.
Next question. All right. Was there any part of the story that you weren't sure about writing besides the erotica? As in something that made you pause and wonder if it was too much?
Yes, I would say almost every act of violence. I would say, yeah, I don't want to like spoil. But
yeah, be just talk in general.
Right. I think, unfortunately, there would be moments where I'd have these ideas and my ideas would always kind of pick the craziest thing, and I would kind of have to reel myself back in. And that was part of how I got to where I, that's kind of how I got to where I landed. But I would say most acts of violence, I tried to be thoughtful about. Also the erotica, you know, anything that is very embodied, dealing with bodies, I tried to navigate that thoughtfully. And you know, because I didn't want it to be the simple, a simple thing. I didn't want it to be one note and unempathetic. But yeah, how my ideas worked is sometimes that I would shoot for the craziest thing and then have to reel myself back in. And I don't want to, I'll tell you guys personally what some of my more insane ideas were, but they were, yeah. But there were some moments, I guess on a more shallow level, where I was like, is this too pulpy? Is this too goofy? How do I make this more serious? And the way I made it more serious was just, I tried to, again, kind of go for the empathy thing, tried not to make it all just, you know, this is the scary part. This is the happy part. This is the sexy part. You know, I tried to kind of mix it all up in a stew.
It works.
What I actually think is scary is that what we ended up with in Fever Chain are you're not your worst thoughts, which that kind of worries me, honestly.
Yeah, maybe it should. Oh, well.
Save them for later.
Yeah. I will say I have limits. Like, I don't know. And I'm trying to figure out what those limits are and how dark I'm kind of willing to go. I haven't read a ton of extreme horror. I've read some of it. I find a lot of it is extreme in like the grossness of it rather than other aspects of it. And I don't mind grossness. I sometimes find it gets too much for me and I just get like tired of it. Like, I'm like,
definitely.
But, anyway,
For me, if it doesn't further the plot, like if it's just for shock value, I don't mind a little bit of it, but if that's the entire point, then it's just really shallow and It doesn't mean anything.
Exactly.
So. Next question.
Sure.
Gwen's initially diagnosed with lupus, which is invisible. Was that a deliberate nod to how chronic illness or queerness gets disbelieved, or just a convenient cover story?
It was both. Also, canis lupus, I'm sorry, it was just on the top of my head.
Yes.
And I think that, honestly, I have a regret. I think if there was anything I could go back and be more thoughtful about, I kind of wish I actually did more research on lupus. I did a very, very quick sort of overview on lupus, a little bit like Wikipedia style. And I don't, you know, I think that obviously it was a cover-up story and it was kind of like a shitty cover-up story. And that's why I did such a shallow, because I mean, you know, it's very loose. It's like, okay, fever, delirium, that is a thing that can happen. That is a thing that can happen to people. And I actually have a fear, like, I hope it doesn't come across as just like, oh, the butt of a joke, like lupus, canis lupus, like, ha ha ha, like, that's actually one of my fears. And I don't know if I should be saying that on podcast, but I kind of meant that flippancy to reflect the character's flippancy a little bit. And the flippancy that I think chronic illness is treated with, I think also just the limits of diagnosis, like, and identity, like the limits of labels, you know, in sort of defining our reality, I think that's part of it. And it's like, okay, we found this label, like, you know, sometimes people, they want to clutch onto it. And it's like, okay, if this is me, then, you know, then I can figure it out and solve it. And I think things were not making sense to Gwen. I don't think she wanted to think about it too hard, but it was starting to catch up with her. And she has a lot of cognitive dissonance, and it's like, I want to cling to the labels, but also like, they're not really working for me.
I think a lot of people are in that position, because you get, this is my identity. This is who and what I am, and everything that's not that is outside of my identity, almost like the antithesis of. So yeah, I get that.
I think the flippancy comes through as well, as in, you know, her parents are so sure of themselves they don't even have to try. You know, they're just like, people will buy it. Don't worry about it. So
true. So yeah, true.
I think
yeah.
It comes through.
Okay, good.
So next question is related. We talked about this in the comments at some point, but I wondered if you had more to say about the Dyer's handling of Gwen's coming out and how that parallels common queer stories. Because we talked about, again, the flippancy, but the kind of the way her dad was and how much they clung to, you know, what they believed. I don't know, but if you want to talk about that.
Sure. That's definitely happening. I don't have it explicit because I just didn't want to do that. But I mean, obviously it's there. You know, I've talked about a lot how the werewolf thing is sort of a satirical allegory for queerness. And I think that with the Dyers, even with Gwen's queerness, and this is kind of all undercurrents and not super explicit, but I think that there's a desire to control the narrative. You know, I didn't want them to be sort of, I didn't really want this anywhere a ton in the book, of just sort of homophobia, just straight up in your face. You know, obviously that's something that people experience in life. Something that I've experienced, and I didn't want full escapism from that, but I wanted some escapism from that, because to me it wasn't very interesting. It was like, okay, like garbage, next, right? You know, but what I wanted was there to be kind of a more interesting thing going on, where it's like, okay, they're not like, you know, just being homophobic to their child, but they are wanting to control the narrative, control their child. That's always been the case. And they want to control their family name, what it means. You know, and Gwen was kind of, you know, the eldest daughter kind of thing going on, high achieving, you know, and so I think as long as she was fulfilling that role, they were happy with it. But, you know, I think it was like, okay, after the college soccer stuff's over, you know, now what? And then the lupus diagnosis.
No, that's perfect. Yeah, I was curious about that, how intertwined that was and what you, how you kind of felt about that.
Next question. So I love that it's you said it in a blue collar diner in just random town in New Jersey. But why choose that over something, you know, gothic, isolated? I'm not complaining, obviously, but what was your reasoning there?
To me, it is gothic, isolated. It is American gothic.
Okay.
New Jersey gothic.
Yeah.
Is that something you'd have to actually, like, go to New Jersey to understand?
I don't think so. A diner gothic.
A new subgenre.
Yeah. It's been I did not invent that. That was, I don't know if it's, it's like, I don't know if it's just a Pinterest board thing or if there's actually, I think there's probably some people who've written about it, but it's a thing. I am from Georgia. Southern Gothic looms large over me and in me. I am frankly intimidated to write Southern Gothic, but I know that I will. And this was a step forward for me in getting there, I think, hopefully. But my partner is from South Jersey, which does encompass the Pine Barrens. She's not from the Pine Barrens, but like near the Pine Barrens. And I was fascinated by New Jersey and where she grew up and by the Pine Barrens. And, you know, of course, Pinetown is fictional. Because when you actually go to the Pine Barrens, I forget what the actual capital of the Pine Barrens is called. It's like CH something, it's, you know, Chinsworth or something. I don't even know, something like that. And we went there and there was like a hot dog stand and like a bunch of Trump signs and like, it was totally dead. And I was like, this is lame. Like, so I, you know, I wanted to invent a town a little bit more going on, maybe a little bit more economic sort of viability happening. So, you know, the Pineland Adventures kind of camping theme park thing going on, more sort of, there are a lot of really wealthy people in New Jersey. And I didn't necessarily know that before living near there. But, you know, having a lot of like wealthy families being like, I'm going to have a big house in the Pine Barrens. That's already, that's kind of a thing, but I kind of leaned into that a little more, you know, oh, we're going to have a homestead in the Pine Barrens kind of thing. I do feel like I am kind of going outside of the question, but I find, oh, McMansion Gothic. That's what I wanted to, McMansion Gothic. That to me is also a thing. You know, the isolation, Pinetown's pretty rural, but it's also kind of suburban. I grew up in suburbia and I found it to be a lonely, weird place. And I think sort of a shadowy place, a lot of liminal spaces, you know, a house that's maybe too big, a yard that's too big, too many cars, roads that are too long. It creates unease because there's a loneliness and like, okay, what's filling up all this space? Is it nothing? Is it something? Does that make sense?
It does, and that went way deeper than I had anticipated.
It does. I think you captured how Pinetown feels. It definitely feels isolated from the rest of the world. Like anything could happen there, and nowhere else, anyone else sorry, no one anywhere up, oh my gosh, no one outside of it would ever hear about it. It would just be covered up or just kind of like this weird rumor. Yeah, I think that was done really well.
Agreed.
And definitely pulling from like small town horror stuff for sure, because it does seem, you know, when you go to like a rural town, it's like, ooh, anything could happen here.
Yeah.
And there's usually like a it's negative lawless. Twinge that, ooh, anything could happen here. Like, people scared.
Having yeah. grown up in a rural town, that is the case. It's kind of creepy at times.
Yeah, same. It's strange when you go back also and you realize like it's desolate and lawless here. And
yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So how does Bianca's family's financial situation tie into the relationship dynamic with Gwen? Obviously, there are references to Gwen's family's wealth, but how does it affect the balance for Bianca?
I think that it does affect it. I think Bianca is a little bit stuck in the American norm of, oh, we're not going to talk about our salaries. And, you know, if I'm struggling financially, I'm going to kind of try to like hide that and not like be open about that. You know, I mean, she's fairly open about it, but, you know, I think her, you know, does she have savings for the future? Like, no, like, does she feel like she has a lot of options? No, you know, she didn't go to college. She kind of sees college as like this magical, wonderful place that, you know, she just never really seriously considered. And I think that for Bianca, she feels very stuck, and her personal financial situation and her family's financial situation is a big part of why she is literally stuck, because it's like, okay, well, what's she gonna do? You know, like she doesn't have a car. You know, that's a big limiting factor that keeps her like trapped. Like in winter horror, like snow often keeps people in, and that, you know, makes it scarier or whatever. And I thought about doing that here, but I was like, oh, I don't really need to. Bianca doesn't have a car. That's sort of the financial. There's definitely a little bit of financial horror. And I think there's horror in the dichotomy of wealth. I mean, Gwen is very flippant with money in a way that is almost disturbing to Bianca. It's exciting and thrilling, but it's also horrific. And it's an imbalance of power that if she really sat down and like really looked at it, I think would make her profoundly uncomfortable. And so I think that that's definitely happening sort of, it probably comes out explicitly maybe a couple times, but it's more kind of happening at like a subconsciously level.
I think that's a great point to make that, yeah, why be snowed in when you are just stuck in stuck in a diner, having to rely on other people to get places. And mm-hmm. Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
All right, next question. So Fever Jam went from a serial with real-time reader feedback to a fixed paperback. Congrats on that. What actually changed between the two versions, and did reader reaction while you were serializing ever alter a plot decision?
Okay, the final version, yeah, no spoilers. The final version is basically the same. It's just slightly polished, and there's no more song lyrics because of copyright law, which I'm sad about, but it's fine. If anything, it would bring more listeners to the music, and you know, it's fine. I have beef with the law. It's okay. Whatever. I get why it's there. But yeah, it's pretty much the same. Which, you know, I think makes it an interesting book. I think it works as a pulp thriller horror thing. Like, you know it's going to be intense, which I tried to, you know, well, everybody tried to convey, like, with the cover, the mouth sort of coming at you. Because there's not a lot of downtime. It's very intense. It's short, but it's an intense story. And I think that that is because it was an online serial and I wanted it to be engaging and I wanted to keep readers reading. And my biggest fear was someone would be like, this is boring, I'm putting it down. So, you know, I tried to lean into that. I tried not to lean too hard into it as time went on, and I kind of, you know, I didn't want it to be 100, 100, 100 all the time. But it definitely, I think because it was a serial, it's a little bit more like, it's a little bit more intense than I think if I was just writing a novel by my lonesome. Mm-hmm. And the reader feedback was very helpful. I did not have the entire plot in my head. I had feelings of what felt right and what did not feel right. And also the readers kind of helped reel me in when I saw how attached they were to certain characters or how much they reacted when certain characters were in danger. It kind of helped reel me in, and it helped me realize the emotional weight of some things that maybe I, you know, sometimes you can't fully see it when you're writing it because it's almost like you're in too deep that you kind of, you're like, it slips over your head. But to a reader, you know, which Emily's audio of the story helped me a lot with this because I would listen to her audio and like, there was one, you know, chapter 11, I was writing it, you know, not a tear in my eye. And then I hear Emily's audio of it. And I mean, this is also just her talent. But like hearing it, I got so emotional and I like cried and I was like, why am I crying? Like, you know, just certain things that like, I don't realize have weight sometimes, or like, I just kind of forget they have weight. I realize later and the readers help me stay in tune with that.
That's interesting. The other thing with that is, so I don't know, maybe this is a separate question, but did you have chapters lined up ahead of time or did that kind of fluctuate? Like how far ahead were you compared to us?
It fluctuated a little bit. I was, in the beginning, I was doing good. I was like 4 chapters ahead and I was doing good. And then life happens and it became a little tight sometimes. But I was always at the very least I was rarely ever 1 chapter ahead. I think that happened like once or twice. But I was usually 2 or more chapters ahead.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So that helped.
It's interesting to write it that way because then you just continue with a certain plot point. Whereas like if you're writing a novel all for yourself, you could go back and say like, actually, I don't like that. Or like, yeah. Ooh, I'm gonna fiddle with that. And that has its benefits, but also it has, I think, great benefits to just pick something and stick with it and make it work. And now your characters are there and like, oh, well, you know, we're going. So yeah,
you're forced.
Yeah, so I think that's really interesting.
I do think it's helpful because when you are writing fiction, the world's your oyster. And when there are werewolves and supernatural things happening, people are open to a much broader reality of things. And when you're making people up, you know, yeah. So I do think the limitations really help with creativity.
Yeah, having too many choices is not always great.
Yeah, agreed. No, it's not.
Ready for the next question?
Yes.
Which side character do you think deserves a spinoff? And were there any characters you disliked writing as?
Ooh, it's a good question. Spinoffs. I think there's 2 competitors for me. Well, there's a couple competitors. I think Erica could have her own spinoff. You know, doing her own thing. I don't know. I don't know if I'm the one to write it, but yeah. And then Emilio too could have a spinoff. Yeah. I could see him sort of, you know, chasing down supernatural creatures and like making movies and having his own TV show. Like, you know, he loves to be a star and he runs towards the danger and excitement. So he'd be fun to follow. And so yeah, I think, but I'm a really big character person. Like I really have a lot of fun writing characters who are even just horrible people. Sometimes they're more fun to write from their perspectives. I don't know if I could do it for a whole novel, you know, some of them, but like in Fever Train, you know, there's like the really brief chapters where we get outside of Bianca's perspective, and those were just a blast. I'm trying to think of my least favorite. I think it's probably the ones where I don't feel like I know the character as well, or the ones where I felt like I didn't already have a really good idea of the character, so I kind of had to figure out the character as I was writing it, and that's like, it was a lot scarier and harder that way, versus like, oh, like, this is Wade. I know how Wade is, easy. Mm-hmm. Like, I definitely had a very clear vision of him. But, you know, later on, probably, you know, in the book, there's a character who I was like, okay, this is someone from the past. I don't have a great idea of who she is. You know, I have an idea of how she impacted certain people, but I kind of had to figure her out. And it's freeing, but it's also that scary thing, like you just talked about, of too many choices and, you know, how could this be interesting sort of thing.
Yeah. We were talking before you came on, when I was reading just the beginning of the book again. And I got to the part where Emilio says he's writing a screenplay. And so we were kind of talking about what that would look like. And I was very curious to read the screenplay.
Oh, his screenplay?
Yeah.
I did not get that far in me writing it, but you know, about the Jersey Devil. Oh gosh. There's a lot of Jersey Devil folklore that I don't know, but it is an interesting rabbit hole. And you know, they have their own cryptid in the Pine Barrens, and it's really interesting. I think Emilio would be all in the lore. He'd be on you know, the YouTube channels, mm-hmm. you know, of people who claimed they saw something. And I think that, you know, he is a smart kid and he toys with the idea of belief. I think that to him, belief is sort of irrelevant. Like, it's relevant, but it's not. Like, he's just fascinated by these things and he wants them to be real in the truest sense to him. And so they are. And yeah, that's what he wants to write about. And I don't know. I feel like it was fun to kind of have an artist in the room and his perspective, because I was able to relate to him in that way of like, oh, like all these scary things happening and people suffering, like, what a bummer, but also, oh, it's so interesting. Like, why is it so interesting to me? Like, there's sort of this exploitive almost aspect to it that, you know, I felt in writing sometimes. And I feel like he maybe related to that somewhat.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of this is making sense.
No, it does, totally.
It makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
Totally. All right. Last question. Without spoiling anything for people who haven't read it, what do you want a reader sitting with after they close the book?
Ooh. Whoa. I don't want to put anything in their heads right now. I want the book to put things in their heads, but I don't want to like tell somebody, oh, this is the right or wrong way to interpret it. Like, I just want people to think and be thoughtful, you know, and hopefully they, you know, cared about the characters and you know, the outcomes of what happened, and can sit with the contradictions of sort of the journey and the ending. I don't want to ever shove something down someone's throat, mainly because I don't think that's persuasive. I think, you know, hopefully it's a lot more interesting for people to kind of draw from their own experiences and use that to come to their own conclusions. Now, that sounds so wishy-washy and like whatever, whatever. Like, obviously, there are some conclusions I wouldn't want people to end with. But, you know, I don't want to say what those are, you know what I mean?
Fair.
But I would say kind of, you know, empathy is huge. And I want that to be a big part of it. And I want people to be thoughtful about power dynamics in society, politically, and relationally. I want people to be thoughtful about that. I want people to be thoughtful about just, you know, passion and lust and all these things, you know, about these things that we romanticize and commodify. And I want people to sit with uncomfortable things and ugly things.
That's fair.
Wow. Yeah. Fuck yeah. All right. So that is the questions. Now we have a game. Do you know how to play this or that?
Is it just where you like say what you want?
Wait. Yeah, you got a choice between A or B, and you got to explain why you chose it. Okay.
Okay. Fun. Yeah.
So we're gonna go around the circle, and we're all gonna do it. And the first one is: would you rather be turned into a vampire or a werewolf? And we'll start with you, Emma.
Werewolf. I don't want to live forever.
Fair. RM.
Before Fever Chain, I would have said vampire, but now I'm werewolf. I think I just love the aspect of being truly wild, you know. And vampires, I mean, they can do whatever they want. They're powerful, immortal, but they're just not wild enough for me, so.
Hell yeah.
And I will also go werewolf because werewolves have always been my go-to. But they're kind of like, vampires are undead. They're cold and bloodless and blah, whereas werewolves are like kind of this intensification of like life itself.
So that's a good point.
I love that. Werewolf Walt.
yes, my never used Tumblr. All right. MA, found footage horror or traditional narration?
I obviously kind of like found footage, but I think at the end of the day, traditional narration. Because found footage, when it's done well, it can be great. But to me, sometimes a shaky camera thing, I'm just like, okay, I'm tired of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's fair. All right. Found footage for me, I think, just because it feels immersive and very unpredictable. And when I go with horror, I really like to be very uncomfortable. So.
All right. Fair enough.
Fair.
I am also going with traditional narration because found footage in my experience is usually very off-putting for me in a not good way. Like it's the whole, okay, I'm tired of this. And please stop that. Just show me the movie. I will say that if it's a like a mockumentary kind of thing, I'm more apt to do the little bits of found footage, whereas like Blair Witch, I hated.
I loved it.
I did love Blair Witch. I did love it.
Oh, no.
So scary.
It's really scary.
See, I didn't get it. I was just like, oh, there's snot on your nose. You should wipe that. That's really gross.
too real.
All right. Question three. MA, eaten alive or die by slow poison?
Ooh. Am I eaten quickly?
Yeah.
Because I feel like slow poison. I don't. And is the poison? I guess I feel the pain.
I'm yeah, we're gonna go feel the pain. Yeah, they're okay. Both painful.
I'd rather be eaten. At least, you know, I'm nourishing something.
I'm gonna go with eaten alive because I think being poisoned slowly, I just hate being sick, so I would really dislike that. And I think eaten alive would just feel, I don't know, I think it would just be kind of an intense I feel like the chemicals going on during that would be pretty cool instead of just slowly wasting away.
Well, cool, but yeah.
Vomiting every day. And, you know, that'd be cool. I think, you know, your body would be like pumping out all these things.
Yeah, at once.
I mean, you would experience like some really wild shit.
Yeah, I'm going with that.
Okay, I'm also going to go with the eaten alive, but not for that reason. Just because I feel like it would be preferable to dying of sickness. Because yeah, I'm like the world's worst sick person here. Man cold is a thing. Yeah. Just ask my wife. She's like, oh my God, shut up. Get up and get it yourself. All right. So weird murder weapon. To murder with or to be murdered with? Liquid nitrogen or cattle prod?
Wait, what was the second one?
Cattle prod. You know, zap, zap. Cattle prod? Oh. The big electric stick prod. Cattle prod.
That was on me. I thought you were saying another chemical that I didn't know, and I was like, how dare you make me look stupid in this way? I would like the cattle prod.
To kill you or to kill someone with?
Oh, I have to answer both.
Yes, both. Sorry.
Both. Okay. I would kill someone with it because it's fun. You know, it's like, yeah, you know, you can be artful with it. And I like to die with it because liquid nitrogen, was that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds painful.
Does that like just melt you?
Yeah.
It freezes you.
Freeze you?
Liquid nitrogen,
freeze you?
Yeah, it freezes you.
I don't know. I don't want to be frozen.
Yeah. There's like an instant freeze.
It feels less personal. So I'd rather, you know, if you're gonna kill me, stick it in there.
RM, you get to follow that up.
It doesn't sound great to be electrocuted with a cattle prod, but I've seen people get those liquid nitrogen brands on their skin, and that's really disgusting looking. So I'm gonna go with, I think I would like to liquid nitrogen someone to death and also be frozen myself. I don't think I could shock someone like and just watch that, you know?
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
I just want to get over
with. Appreciate
it's just, ugh. And yeah. The things you would see and the things their face would do, I don't really want it. And I also don't want to watch someone to watch me do that. So I'm frozen both ways.
I'm also going with liquid nitrogen because it's just really cool when things shatter. But it would have to be like full body motion. So you like, you know, ice cube wall, and then you drop me on the concrete floor and I just little bits go everywhere. I would also choose that for the murder. So okay. So next question. Would you like to have a monster that you can bring home to mom, or a monster that will eat mom if you try?
Wait, a monster that would eat mom if I tried to bring the monster home?
Yes. Or the one that, you know, it's a friendly monster. Basically, would you rather have a friendly one or a vicious one?
I mean, you know, friendly. But I would like vicious on my terms, right?
A little garden monster.
You know, you can be vicious now. Go ahead and good after that one. But yeah, probably with my mom, you know, I won't go there quite into detail, but, you know, she can live.
Okay.
She can live, I guess. I'm going with the vicious monster that would, because even if they don't eat my mother, I would like my mother to be very frightened in the presence of my partner. Yeah,
I guess.
I'm going to go with the nice monster, and I'm going to name him Timothy.
Oh my gosh, I'm just imagining a giant. Yeah.
Like the size of a VW bug.
Wow.
That's cute.
Pork roll or bacon?
This is contentious in my household.
That's why it's in.
I know. I'm team bacon. I'm sorry.
Is there a why? Just because?
Oh yeah, why? Pork roll is good, but bacon to me is just unbeatable. I like the variety. You get a little bit of meat, you get like the chunks of fat in there, like, you know, and I don't know, maybe some people think it's gross. I kind of like in the meat where I can see what's going on. I'm like, okay, here's I don't even know what I'm talking about. It's like, here's the fat, here's the meat. I like to be able to see that, and then I can be like, if I bite here, I'll get like a nice ratio. But in pork rolls, gotcha. All one note. It's all just pink slime.
Ugh.
That they hardened, I don't know. You know, it's all animal parts that's just been blended up, you know? And, you know, I get that. I get the appeal. But
There's no appeal.
I get it.
Aria, bacon or pork roll?
Bacon. Same reason. I like it crispy. Mm. I like the variance in the textures as well. Bacon.
Fair.
And yeah, the blended meat is never. Yeah.
Well, I'm a vegetarian, so I would choose neither at the moment. But there was a point in time that you could have paid me in bacon, and I would have been happy just because bacon. There doesn't need to be a reason. It was bacon.
Yeah.
All right. Something bookish. Do you like to reread your favorite scares, or are you always chasing something new? Like, I know my son does not reread books.
I am becoming a better reader day by day. I used to not be as good of a reader. I am also pretty new to reading horror regularly. And so to me, I would reread. There are some horror books that I've read that I'm like, oh, I would totally reread that. You know, Carrie being one of them, for example. You know, it's just a classic, and it's a story that I think will resonate, you know, after I die even. So I think, like, you know, the horror stories that are kind of timeless like that and really impact, you know, culture like that, like I am interested in kind of revisiting and, you know, but I still have so much to read, so I won't be rereading too much.
Fair. RM?
I'm not a big rereader, but I have read Dracula 3 times. And I think it's because in horror, you have all of the little clues leading up to, you know, a big event or things you didn't quite grasp the first time. I think I love to have the ending and then go back and feel it from, you know, the other side where you know what's going to happen. So yeah, for horror, I would reread.
I am also a rereader, and mostly for that, but also because I just want to go back and hang out with those people again in, you know, certain instances, not always, but I mean, it's kind of the same thing across all genres. If it's a favorite book, you know, whether we're talking about The Hobbit or, you know, Salem's Lot. So.
Yeah.
All right, next one. You're in a horror movie. Do you save your love interest or do they save you?
Oh, God. Yeah, I get saved. big time. No question. No question. Yeah, I don't think I'd be all that helpful.
You're the one that goes down the stairs in the dark. Looking for the light switch without a weapon, right?
Maybe like really unwittingly. Like I think I'm kind of the one who's so oblivious, you know, or like so out of it that I get myself into trouble. I definitely wouldn't like actively pursue, oh, what's that sound? Let me go in there. That's not me. I'd be like, oh, what's that? Like, we gotta get out of here, you know? But I kind of would stupidly, I think, get myself in trouble. Mm-hmm.
RM?
I think I would save my love interest. I would be the one doing stupid things to save them, and then I'd probably get killed and not save them. So
you would try, but
yeah,
I would be unsuccessful.
Yeah, I think it scares me more to kind of sit still and hide, or I think I would just be like, let's you know, go for it. And I don't think I could sit back and watch them be in danger. Like I said, I would just like rather run through the fire and just be done with my own torment.
I would end up needing to be saved because of that reason. I can't just sit there. I'm gonna have to go do something, but it will probably turn out wrong. So I will end up needing to be saved. All right, we got two more. If you were a werewolf, would you be a lone wolf or part of a pack?
If
you were a werewolf, would you be a lone wolf? Oh, okay. Yeah. Never mind. It's late. Leave me alone.
That was perfect.
Kidding. I would be in a pack. I think, you know, lone wolves, it's tough out there. And also it's like, why are you alone? You know, is there a reason for that? You know,
I guess their name is Chad.
Right. Yeah. Like, I don't know. I think being in a pack, you're a lot safer when you're able to be around people who understand what it's like to be a werewolf. Cause you know, it ain't easy.
Definitely not easy. RM.
I would be in a pack. I think there's a lot of social benefits to being in a pack.
Pack for me also, and for all the same reasons, because, you know, lone wolf, it sounds all fun when you're, no, you're 12 and you're like, oh yeah, I'd be the lone wolf, but no, that's stupid. You're gonna die. You're gonna die out there all by yourself.
No one's gonna be able to get you out of that bear trap.
Exactly.
Yep.
All right, last question. Cake or pie?
Pie.
There you go.
So much better than cake. There, so you know, goes back. It's like bacon versus pork roll. Well, I guess cake has layers, whatever. It depends on the cake. But so like pie, yeah. But yeah, I like them with pie. I kind of like when the crust is like buttery, but not too sweet. And then you get like the sweet center and like, you know, and then maybe you put ice cream on top, maybe you put whipped cream on top, maybe you put nothing on top. Then you have a healthy breakfast, right? So yeah, it's like, I like the versatility of pie.
Wow. Yes.
You're very fired up about this one.
There's a love of pie there. RM?
Pie. Cake is trying, again, too uniform. It's trying too hard to be dry and moist at the same time. You know, it just is, it's weird. So again, I like the separation of textures. Pie.
I am also choosing pie because it's pie. I mean, fuck cake. Cake is dry and cake boring. Is and blah.
Yeah. And then you try and put, what I hate when people try and put like a jelly in between the layers of cake, and then it's
it's like dry and then goo and then dry.
It's worse. Yeah, it's very bad.
I don't have the texture thing. Everything can be a casserole or a sandwich to me. Cake is just dry.
Yeah.
We should go get some pie.
We should all get pie and bacon together.
Yeah, we should.
I'm down.
It sounds like the ultimate combination.
It does. Ooh, we could do that chocolate covered bacon.
Oh my gosh. Okay, you're going too far, Walt.
Have you ever had it?
I actually don't know if I have. I feel like I haven't, maybe. I've had like a date covered in bacon. Mm. That was good.
Oh.
But no, I don't think I've had chocolate bacon.
When we lived in Georgia, we went to the Renfest like annually. They had chocolate covered bacon there. And it was so fucking good.
I'll have to try it.
But it sometimes was off because it really needs to be crispy because the lip bacon covered in chocolate is just really gross. I mean, I don't have textural issues, but that is enough to give anybody a problem. Crispy bacon with chocolate.
Yeah.
Well, that was fun, y'all.
Yes.
That was really fun. Yeah, I fucking loved it. I had a fucking blast. Oh, my God.
That's perfect.
You can grab your copy of Fever Chain by M.A. Knight online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other booksellers. You can also get it directly through the publisher at DrekDeathAndDoom.com. It's closing time, so get to the bar for last call. Make sure to tip your server and hit follow on your podcast app so you can join us next time. We're new here, so if you dig what we're doing, drop a review.